Hello, everybody. I'm Howie Hawkins. I was the Green Party and the Socialist Party candidate for president in 2020. And this podcast, Green Socialist Notes, is about continuing to educate and organize around the eco-socialist program that my running mate, Angela Walker, and I ran on in 2020. And so we got a guest today, Bo Forte, who is running for the 5th Congressional District in New Jersey, and we'll have him on in a couple minutes. I just wanted to make a few comments first. I was out petitioning since 6 this morning at the regional market, and like I told you last week, I had 165 at the regional market. Today, I got 170, but last week, I also was able to go to a crawfish festival after the podcast and got another 87 more. So I got 252 for the day, which is probably going to be my best day in these 45 days in which we have to get 45,000 signatures. You know, today I ran into more than previously these Democrats clutching their pearls about, oh, you're going to hurt Biden against Trump, even though if Trump will get clobbered in New York. And if he wins New York, he landslid the country. But that's not going to happen. I ran into more people who signed for Robert F. Kennedy Jr., who is paying millions of dollars for paid petitioners all over the state. So they're probably going to get on the ballot. But I ran into a lot of signers who regretted having signed for Kennedy when they found out there was a green alternative. Ran into fewer Trumpies today. I don't know what they were doing today, but they weren't coming by my table. Maybe it's because I was in the produce shed, not the flea market shed. So if your state has to petition, I hope you Greens out there are petitioning or getting ready to petition. And if you don't have to do that, and even if you do, like in New Jersey or Pennsylvania or Connecticut, we could really use your help here now in New York. We got just about 17, 18 days left. We have to get 45,000 signatures in 42 days. That's no joke. In fact, it's a crime against democracy that was brought to us by the corporate Dems, particularly Andrew Cuomo, who got mad when I got 5% of the vote running for governor. And he wanted to run up the vote, get more than he got in 2010 when he was first elected, more than he got than his daddy ever got, and he got less. And he had to look at what we were calling for. And in order to compete for our vote, he adopted some of the things we were running on that he wouldn't support during the campaign, including a ban on fracking, raising the minimum wage, and paid family leave. So anyway, if you can get to New York, we can use your help in the next couple of weeks. And then, you know, Gaza's still top of the headlines right now, and the carnage in Rafah has begun. Israel's going in there. Hamas agreed to a ceasefire and hostage for prisoners exchange, a deal that Egypt, Qatar, and the U.S. brokered, and the Israeli leaders rejected it. And they're saying the U.S. didn't inform them of all the details. And I think that's just a load of crap. The truth is Netanyahu wants the war to continue indefinitely because when it ends, he's going to have to face those trials. He's very unpopular. His government will be overthrown. They'll call a new election and he'll face the corruption charges hanging over his head and probably end up going to prison. So, you know, that war is continuing because of him and his situation and the far right part of his coalition. You know, they're all about ethnic cleansing of Palestinians from the whole territory. So that's a bad situation. Now, another significant thing that happened is Biden paused the delivery of heavy munitions like 2,000-pound bombs, which are blockbusters, and artillery shells for the tanks, and howitzers that Israel wants to use for its invasion of Rafah. Now, a pause on arms is not all we want, but it is significant. It's really the first time since 1982 under the Reagan administration where the U.S. paused arms. At that time, they did it several times over the Israeli invasion of Lebanon to expel the PLO from Lebanon. And Israel backed off every time we did that. We have the other case of 1956 when the Eisenhower administration stopped the arms and threatened sanctions against Israel if it didn't withdraw from its joint invasion of Egypt with Britain and France to take back the Suez Canal. I mean, that shows that the U.S. did, and even more so now, has leverage over Israel because of all the arms we provided. So that pause is significant. But at the same time, Biden is still talking about supporting Israel's military goals against Hamas in Gaza. And then yesterday, the State Department issued finally its report on the human rights issues related to arms and some laws that affect that. And they said it is, quote unquote, reasonable to assess that Israel has violated international law in its war in Gaza. But then it concluded, kind of inconsistently, they had not found enough specific incidents to justify withholding military aid to Israel. So it's a mealy-mouthed report. In any case, we're at a significant point, maybe even a turning point in U.S. policy, but maybe not. But what that means is we got to keep the pressure up on a ceasefire. I think our activity is making the difference. Got to keep calling for humanitarian aid, a hostage and prisoners exchange, and really a peace process to solve the underlying causes of the conflict, ceasefire and then real negotiations. And if we keep the pressure up, maybe we can move the Biden administration a little more. And then Ukraine, Russia started a new offensive yesterday in Kharkiv Oblast. Oblast is like a state. And Ukraine had expelled Russia from that region in the fall of 2022. But Russia's coming back with the same tactics, which is to bomb villages to smithereens in order to depopulate them and occupy them. Ukraine's second largest city, Kharkiv, is the capital of that oblast. But it's a 2 million person city. Doesn't seem to be under immediate threat. In fact, today Russia destroyed the bridge over the Seversky Donets River, which would be the path for the Russians to get over that river toward the city of Kyiv. But what destroying that bridge also did was destroy Ukraine's main path to get reinforcements to the front. So it looks like Russia's trying to take over and occupy the land west of the city of Kharkiv. It would take a much larger force than they've deployed so far to take over that city. But Russia, in terms of the city, has been bombing its energy infrastructure and its apartment blocks intensely in recent weeks. And that seems to be, you know, they're going to do it what they did to Mariupol and just, you know, force everybody to leave. That seems to be their goal. And all I've got to say to these so-called peace activists who say the war in Ukraine will stop when the U.S. stops sending arms to Ukraine is that they're fools. I mean, Russia has increased its attacks precisely because U.S. arms were delayed for six months. And they still haven't reached the front lines in any quantity. And as Putin said last month, why should he negotiate a peace deal with Ukraine when it is running out of ammunition? So like we demanded American troops out of Vietnam, we should demand Russian troops out of Ukraine. There's nothing to negotiate. Imperialist aggressors have no right to invade, occupy, and dominate other countries. So there's nothing to negotiate. It just should be, like we said in Vietnam, troops out now. And then finally, I want to call your attention to what's going on in West Papua, another place where civilians are being bombed and there's a genocide going on. Indonesia is bombing villages in West Papua more than they have recently. There's brutal torture and just unspeakable racist brutality toward the Black indigenous people of West Papua by the Indonesians. They just elected a new president, Zaid Ra'ad Al Hussein, who's a former general who was responsible for massacres in East Timor as well as West Papua, and has promised to escalate Indonesian military operations in West Papua. Indonesia, and this is before this new president, has refused to allow UN human rights inspectors into West Papua since 2018. And in that time, since 2018, over 100,000 West Papuans have been killed by the Indonesian army. And this is one where the U.S. is on the wrong side. We back and do, you know, provide arms and military cooperation with the Indonesian military. And what this is all about is the U.S. mining giant Freeport's copper and gold mine. And meanwhile, the Chinese are, you know, they are the ones who are involved with other companies from Hong Kong and Singapore and cutting down the largest rainforest in Southeast Asia for timber. So the indigenous people who live off the forest are being dispossessed from their livelihoods. It's really another genocide. And, you know, I've been working with Andrew Kudupai, who was on our program a few weeks ago, or maybe a month and a half ago. And he's working on setting up a Green Party in West Papua. He's in Papua New Guinea, the other side of the big island of New Guinea. And they've arranged for two women from this West Papua Green Party to be at the Asian Pacific Green Party Congress in Fiji in June. So anyway, we'll have more on that in future podcasts. So that's just some comments on current events, but let's get to Beau Forte and see what's going on with his campaign. He should pop up on the screen here. There he is. Hi, Beau.
How you doing?
Bo, I'm going to let you take it from here. Tell us, you know, who you are, who you're running against, what the issues are, and why, you know, Greens should support you.
Sure. Well, first and foremost.
And the voters generally, not just Greens.
Of course. First, I want to say, you know, what an honor it is to be here. Thank you, Mr. Hawkins. I supported your campaign 4 years ago.
Just call me Howie.
I think very highly of you, Howie, and it really is a pleasure to be here. It's an honor.
Thanks for coming.
Again, Beau Forte, I'm running the 5th District of New Jersey. It is the district that runs along the whole New York State upper border and then kind of makes an L shape and comes down along the Delaware River into the Pocono border of Pennsylvania. So there's two real major reasons that I'm in this race, because anyone who grew up with me or knows me, that maybe they know that I'm somewhat intelligent, but they would never think that this would be the arena I would jump into. For years, I was the medical proxy and the power of attorney for my father. I was his only child. He was very ill for a long time. So, you know, I had a front row seat to how messed up our healthcare system is and how badly it needs to change, or at least catch up to everybody else who does offer healthcare as a human right in this world. You know, between supplements, Medicare, denials. You know, when people are really sick and really worried, one of their worries shouldn't be, you know, this could deplete everything I saved, everything I worked for, just because I got sick. I think that's a crime against humanity, really, especially when we're talking about we are in the wealthiest country in the world. And the places, the institutions that you go to outside of the hospital. Now, North Jersey has some very good hospitals. And I will say the hospitals he stayed in were excellent. But then when the hospital needs to remove you and they send you what they call a rehab center, I don't know how many people have dealt with them, but these are truly, I mean, my father went through at least 6-7 rehab centers, not one that we came out of with a good feeling at, or frankly, that I didn't feel was a criminal institution. These places put profit way ahead of care. The overnight staffs are, you know, you really can't blame them. I mean, when you're paying people such low wages to do the jobs that these people are doing, you know, I don't know what you expect. There's people that sleep on the job. I mean, when he was incapacitated and needed a nurse overnight, sometimes he would wait 3-4 hours to the point where he'd call 911 to have someone come and tell them that, you know, you got a guy there that really needs help. So, you know, I don't want to get off on a tangent on that. I think a lot of people who have been through the system know how awful it is. Unfortunately, in my district, the Democratic incumbent is very deeply in the pockets of the health insurance lobby, is vehemently against universal health care. He's a disciple of the Clintons and Joe Lieberman. And we all know what Joe did when it came to health care. So, you know, it should always be on the ballot. And certainly, I'm sure the Republican, whoever it will be come June, is also not going to be in favor of universal health care. So that's one. My other issue was that I do have personal history with Josh Gottheimer, the incumbent, my opponent. You know, it was a couple of years ago as I was dealing with my father, but that wasn't really the root cause. But, you know, a lot of his policies are awful. If you really look into this guy, he's a machine in the Democratic Party. He's really one of the quiet leaders. He's one of their biggest fundraisers. He's got almost $20 million in his campaign funds. I mean, it's overwhelming what I'm going up against. But, you know, I sent him a nasty letter once, and I had sent him a lot of letters, but this one was particularly nasty. It was about healthcare, I believe. Or no, it was about a protest from some group. A young group went and protested his house over, climate change, which he's also an enemy of. And a couple got arrested. But if you read the story the next day in the paper, when he quoted himself, he was in D.C., but his family's home. And he tried to claim that his wife, you know, was worried for her. She feared for her life. And his kids were so afraid. I mean, you know, this group, which I think was called the Sunshine Group or the Sunshine Network, you know, they're a group of young, what I would call hippie activists, nothing threatening about them. A couple of them got arrested for trespassing because they stood on his lawn. To come, I mean, these are supposed to be, if you're a Democrat, these are supposed to be your allies. And to come out and say that they were, you know, a group of degenerates, these are kids that care about the climate and their future. That's all. They have a disagreement with you. They might not, maybe they shouldn't have went to your home. Anyway, I sent them a nasty letter about that. That night, I get a call from the Capitol Police inferring that, you know, because I did mention something where I said in a joking way, maybe in bad taste, you know, if your wife was so worried, maybe you could lend her the bulletproof vest that you wear when you go to Patterson. That's a whole nother story. That was, he was made fun of a lot. He actually went to Bill Pascrell's birthday party at a bar in Patterson and showed up in a bulletproof vest. They all made fun of him. It was a known story. So I used to, you know, rib him about that. Like, what a man of the people would go to a bar in a bulletproof vest. You know, that's not what a representative should do. Anyway, I explain it to the Capitol policeman. He says, listen, I understand, but please be careful in your words. So we understood. The next day, I was hot about it. I'm thinking to myself, how could this guy send, you know, I have no criminal record. I have a family. I pay taxes. I do all that. You're going to send the Capitol Police after me because you didn't like a letter. And the next day, I sent them another one. Again, mean, but not certainly not criminal. Forget about it. 3 months later in the mail, I get a letter from, you know, Bergen County Superior Court saying that he's charging me personally with harassment. And that case went on for six hearings and a trial. The mayor of Oakland, who is a Democrat, big time friend of Josh, I argued that she shouldn't have been on the case. Now, I will say something about this, and I don't recommend this to anybody, but if you're charged with a crime, get a lawyer. I felt that this was so frivolous that I didn't even lawyer up. I knew that's what Josh wanted. He knows that, you know, I'm not a rich guy. Shelling out $5,000 to $10,000 for an attorney to make this go away was going to hurt me. So I wouldn't even give him that satisfaction. But long story short, after six hearings and a trial, the judge threw it away, said, you know, this is a public official. Part of being a public official is taking some nasty, you know, letters and comments from your constituents. There's nothing criminal here, so on and so forth. So they threw it away. But that is the second reason. That was the overwhelming push to get me to decide, you know, we need change. We're not getting it. It's been, he's done this four times, 8 years now. He's never had a serious challenger, which I wonder if the GOP up there even assists him in getting elected, because there was a story in 20 that he voted with Trump more than any other Democrat. It was over 75% of the time. So, you know, this was why I decided that even someone like me should get in there and do this. And hopefully it inspires other people. I mean, you don't have to be rich. You don't have to be Brad Pitt. You don't have to be politically connected to try to get rid of the worst people that are representing you now. Get out there and do it. So that's my story on why I'm running.
All right. Well, I can tell you from talking to a lot of voters petitioning today and previously, a lot of people feel that way. They are so disgusted. They just want another alternative on the ballot. And I think, candidates like you in a few places are going to surprise in this election because people are really disgusted. Now, I don't know the details of how this guy is regarded in your district. Tell us a little bit about the nature of your district. Who was the Democrat before him, or was it a Democrat?
It's been Republican for a long time. That's why Democrats were kind of happy that he flipped the seat. Mm-hmm. It was Scott Garrett before him, who was a very, very right-wing Republican. And before Scott, he had it for at least 6, 7, 8 terms. He was there for almost 20 years. Prior to him was a woman named Marge Rokema. You might remember her. She was a Republican, but a very moderate one. I know she banged heads with Reagan a lot of the time. So she was actually not a bad representative. Again, I was a kid. I don't remember her that well, but I know that she was a very, very moderate, typical Northeast Republican, not what they've become today. Today, she'd probably be a Democrat because the Democrats have filled in that center party. We don't really have a left in this country, as you know. So,
yeah. So what about the demographics of the district? Is it urban, suburban, rural?
Suburban and rural, very wealthy. It encompasses three counties. So you have the northern half of Bergen County, which is the richest part of the county. And Bergen County is one of the richest counties, not only in the state, but in the country. And then it encompasses a small piece of Passaic County, which is the more rural part along the New York state border. That's the town I live in, West Milford. And then it goes out to Sussex County. It kind of makes like an L down the Delaware River a little bit. And Sussex County is very rural. I wouldn't say poor, but certainly working class. They certainly don't get the attention that the eastern part of the district does. It's a very gerrymandered district now since Josh won it. They've made it very hard for him to lose. And what you said before, is he well-liked? He is not well-liked. He's very vulnerable. He wins every election somewhere between 53 and 55% to 45, 47%. So, you know, he's not a secure seat, even though the media makes it seem like he is. He's a media darling. He's a huge AIPAC guy, huge Israel guy. You know, anti-universal health care, comes out and calls it socialist health care like Bernie Sanders. He's been quoted saying nobody wants that. It's socialism. Just a bad guy.
Well, I think one of the things you're going to hear is that you're splitting the vote. And, you know, you're going to bring in a Republican and the Republican's probably going to be a Trumpy, most likely. Although a wealthy district might have one of those country club Republicans. I don't know. But, you know, in my experience in this district I live in, we've had Republicans forever, except twice. The only two times the Greens ran a candidate is the only times the Democrats won. And we got, you know, 6 to 8% of the vote. But the Democrat had to, you know, respond to what we were putting forward and sounded a lot better than they did when they were just running against a Republican, where they moved to the right and they lost the enthusiasm of their base. So
I'm going to make two counterpoints to that. First one is that I would argue that while Josh is part of the Democratic Party, he's splitting my vote. If you're a real progressive, you can't vote for this guy. It's impossible. He's good in two places if you're a Democrat. And I got to give it to him here. He's good on abortion rights, and he's good on LGBTQ plus rights. But again, a guy like Josh Gottheimer, he's only good on those issues because those issues are popular in his district. I believe that Josh is what you'd call a fair weather fan, if you will. He'll go with the flow. He's for sale. And, you know, what will get him in office is what he will fight for. And then the second point on that is I'm in a very unique position because another thing I'm running on that's very important to me is expansion of Congress. And I'm going to try to argue to my constituent. I've lived here all my life. If we can expand Congress, in 1920, the country had a population of about 106 million people. Those people were represented by 435 members of Congress. Today, we have a population of about 330 million people, and we are still only represented by 435 members of Congress. So my district is about 800,000 people. If I can get across the message to the people in Sussex County and really all over the district that, hey, we might not agree on everything, but if I could get these districts to shrink down, it is not only going to improve your voice and make you better heard, because Sussex County is completely shut out now by, you know, Bergen County Democrats. They have all the power and all the wealth. If we shrink these down and cut them into thirds like we should, you know, all of a sudden your district could really reflect you. It's going to make it harder for whoever you elect to hide from you like they do now. It'll make it much harder to gerrymander districts because they'll be too small. You'd really have to go in there with a fine-tooth comb to figure out how to make a party win. You'd start seeing parties like Green Party. You'd start seeing parties like Reform Party and the Libertarians start winning seats, which is good for democracy. And lastly, it's going to make it much harder for corporations to buy votes because if all of a sudden there's 1,200 members of Congress, it's going to be very difficult for them to buy 650 votes.
Yeah, and one of the reasons they like to take away our local rights or our state's rights on a lot of issues is that it's easier to buy one Congress than 50 state legislatures.
Absolutely.
Or thousands of municipalities.
Absolutely.
They don't have the grassroots strength or, you know, popularity to do that, but they can go down behind the curtains in D.C. and buy people, you know, not literally, except sometimes like Menendez, but, you know, through campaign donations and the prospects of really lucrative jobs once they retire from their elected position.
Right. Which should be tracked, too. I mean, Scott Garrett, the guy that was in before Josh, he's working either for some big PR firm or in the banking industry, which he helped for all his years in Congress. I mean, something like that really needs to be looked into. Bob Torricelli's a big, you know, for some consulting firm, probably a do-nothing job. I don't know if you remember Bob Torricelli. He was a senator and a congressman here in North Jersey, very corrupt. But, you know, the payoff is there afterwards. So even if they get thrown out, even if they get, you know, hit with a charge that doesn't really see them do any real time, there's something waiting for them out there. And it's really horrible. It's why we are where we are right now.
Yeah, that reminds me of the news this week about Paul Manafort, you know, corrupt as hell, working for Russian and Ukrainian oligarchs and dictators around the world. The lobbying organization he had with Roger Stone and them was called the Lobby for Dictators. You know, he got convicted of white collar crimes and went to jail. Trump pardoned him, and now he's involved in this big deal with a Chinese telecom. It's unbelievable. You know, these people, you know, they there's like a safety net under them while the rest of us are slamming to the floor.
Yeah, it's awful. I mean, and it's but again, you know, like, you know, Howie, I think it's something like 65% of the country wants Medicare for all in some form. They want universal health care some way. And we're not even close to getting there because it doesn't matter. Something like 75% of Congress is against it. And that's the 75% that are probably getting big contributions from the health insurance lobby and so on and so forth. I mean, if we shrank these districts on a federal level, I think we'd see not only things start to change, but you'd start to see some type of a restoration of trust in government, which is essential right now. I mean, we need to start talking again. Everyone's locked in their bubbles and nobody wants to hear from anybody else. We need to bring back the fairness doctrine where if Sean Hannity wants a show, he's got to have an Alan Combs. You know, we need to hear both sides in order to make a proper decision on how we feel.
Yeah, I'm with you on more representatives, but I would like to see it done for multi-member districts so we can get proportional representation.
I think that
will be the way. The Greens certainly will get their fair and proportional share of representatives in the House of Representatives. And that would be the game changer, because once we have that platform, that legitimacy, and our people are on the news every day giving our point of view, it's just going to change the politics of this country so much.
I agree.
Are you familiar with the Fair Representation Act?
Yes, but you might have to fill me in a little bit.
Well, it provides for ranked choice voting for senators and then proportional ranked choice voting for multi-member districts for the House of Representatives.
I am familiar, yes.
And it has nine sponsors, Fair Vote and the advocates of ranked choice voting and proportional representation are behind it. But where the hell is the squad, let alone the Progressive Caucus on that bill? I mean, that's something that, you know, progressives should be for, but there is Jamie Raskin's behind it. And I think Ro Khanna is on it. Not sure about that, but I think they're two out of the nine. And, you know, the others are nominally, including the sponsor, Progressive Caucus. But the sponsor, Dan Beyer, who's from, or Beyer from Virginia, is also in the New Democrat Coalition, which is the corporate Democrats. He's on both of them. So
yeah, I mean, and that's why it's becoming hard to take the Progressive Caucus very seriously anymore.
Yeah, that's true. Well, listen, I'm seeing a lot of questions in the chat, so why don't we get to questions? I think Chris behind the screen has been accumulating those, and he'll throw them up on the screen, and I'll read them, and then we'll answer.
Do the best I can.
Okay, Trey Woodford. How do you plan to get the wealthier population to get behind a green socialist platform?
I think it's very difficult. I don't know if that's really the key to winning this right now. But in the end, I mean, we have to educate people. And no matter how much money you have, we still just have one planet. We have to convince them and show them that the future is more sustainable energy, a more green platform, something that's going to ensure that their kids can live the same way they did, their parents did, their grandparents did. I mean, no matter how much money you have, you are not safe from the climate emergency. We have to get them in line to an extent. And, you know, but I really think change first is going to come from the working class, as it usually does. And then once we start rolling that ball, you know, listen, there's people that are wealthy that know this, that are on our side. When we get rolling, that's how we do it. But it is certainly an uphill battle.
In my experience, even, you know, affluent people or people that call themselves liberals or conservatives, not socialists, when you talk to them about the specific programs like universal public health care system, oh, yeah, they want that. You know, Fox News did a poll right after the 2020 election, and they worded it in a way that they thought would repel people. You know, you want the federal government to pay for everybody's health care in a universal system. And 72% said, hell yeah. You know, and there, you know, a lot of Republicans in that poll. I used to work with, he's passed on now, but a guy worked at Carrier before it ran off to China. He was a conservative, but he was for public power of the utility, universal public health care, you know, a single payer system. Mm-hmm. Another one, I don't know if he was for this, but a lot of people are. You say, we need a public bank, you know, so we can finance things that the private banks are not and serve as a yardstick, a standard against which the commercial banks have to compete with.
100%.
And people say, yeah. And these are, you know, so I think, you know, when there's a difference between, you know, agitation, slogans, and specific issues and, you know, the education you do around a perspective on the system. And I think in an election campaign, you're not, you know, your slogan's not socialism. Your slogan is universal health care, Green New Deal, you know, those kinds of things. And
correct.
A lot of people who will not call themselves socialists will vote for a socialist who's for those things.
Yes. Yes, of course.
Yeah.
It makes sense. A lot of what we're talking about is not radical. You go to other countries, they're implementing it and they're thriving on it. So come on, this America, you want to be the best, let's do it.
Yeah, that's the kind of language that people respond to.
Yes. But it's the truth.
Yeah. Z Manny, what can we do at the local level to push the institutions and administration to actually serve the public? Many of our institutions feel hollowed out, trying to exploit us instead of serve us.
That's a good question. We have to turn out. We have to educate ourselves. We have to ask questions. We have to elect people that feel beholden to us, that will answer our questions. In my district, for instance, I'm running against the guy who hasn't had a real town hall since he's been elected the first time in 2016. I mean, dialogue. I tell this to people in the Green Party. I tell this to people on the right side of the fence, Democrats. It really all comes down to dialogue. We need to have an honest conversation in order to figure out what the problem is and then come up with an honest solution. But, you know, the way we do it at a local level is, listen, election day, you got to come and you got to vote and you got to know what you're voting for.
And I would add to that, we need to transform the institutions so they're more democratic.
Yes.
So that the elected officials have to respond. Like if city councilors had to answer to neighborhood assemblies, where all the people can meet and decide where they stand on an issue and then tell their representative on the city council, this is what we want. That would create a dialogue they have to deal with because there's power. That's the key thing. We can dialogue. They'll sort of give us all the public hearings we want. They'll pat us on the back and say they're really with us, but then they aren't.
Right.
So, you know, that's what I mean. We got to transform the institutions or like in delivery of public services. Bo, you and I were talking about this before we came on, delivery of health care. With Medicare, it's a very centralized bureaucracy, and you can't get a response.
Right.
Whereas the National Health Service proposal that I've advocated, it was legislation at the federal level in the from 1977 until 97. You would elect a local health board of both from the community and the healthcare workers, and it in turn would elect the district, regional, and national health boards so that the people could make the system responsive to them.
Yep.
Like one problem in healthcare is resources are not put in low-income districts. They tend to be concentrated, you know, around downtown or the university. So there aren't clinics in the neighborhoods. Mm-hmm. But if the neighborhoods could say, we want clinics, they in a system where they have power, they'd get clinics.
They would. Healthcare is not the only place I think we could do that, too. I think there should always be a strong citizen board with that has teeth that, you know, oversees their local police force, their county police force, their state police force, and so on and so forth. You know, always doing things from the bottom up is the best solution. Hope that answered Z Manny's question.
Yeah, I hope it did, too. Just waiting for that next one to pop up. Here we go. Scout Trooper 164. What are your views on the Russo-Ukrainian war?
So it's not one of my pillar issues, but I'll say this from a personal standpoint. I have a few views. First, obviously, it's never good when an imperialistic force comes in and tries to tell someone else what to do. I'm always opposed to that. And I do put a big but in there. Again, My one of my main issues is universal health care. I am a strong believer that that money needs to help Americans. I know this kind of falls in line with a conservative view, but it's different because I want this to actually work. Of course, I want to help countries in need. At the same time, there's so much money here. We can do both. But, you know, when I see my elected representatives working overtime to help Israel defend itself, to help Ukraine defend itself. And I'm not saying that these may not be important. Of course, some are more important than the others. I'm just, because these are the two big ones right now. You know, I look at the situation I went through. I look at the situation that a lot of baby boomers, especially right now, are going through, where they worked hard their whole lives. They saved their whole lives. They did everything right. And now all of a sudden, you know, like we're all going to do, they're starting to get sick and they're starting to get older, and you know, they're seeing the nightmare of the American dream that, you know, you can work as hard as you need to, you can save as much money and you can achieve your goals, and it still doesn't mean anything. So, you know, do I feel for Ukraine? I do. Do I think I need to be a little more educated before I give you a really good opinion on that? Probably. But again, I'd like to see more of our resources used for us, and not just us, the wealthy us. I'm talking about the working us, especially when, you know, 1,000 people every day in this country go bankrupt solely due to their personal medical bills. And I think it's more than that, but let's say it's 1,000 a day. That's 352,000 people a year. I mean, you know, can we spend a little money to make sure that that doesn't happen first?
Yeah, I agree. Let me just try a little education on this question for you.
Please.
Dean Baker at the Center for Economic CEPRs, it's a progressive think tank in Washington, D.C., last fall calculated that we spend on Ukraine and aid, this includes economic, humanitarian, as well as military aid, 0.3% of our gross domestic product and 0.6% of our federal budget, which means we can do that to help them defend themselves and, you know, survive the catastrophe to their economy, and also provide for the rest of us the things we need. And one way we do that is cut the rest of that fat, bloated military budget, a lot of which is corruption and self-dealing and, you know,
corporate welfare.
Account for where the money went.
Yep.
The other thing is tax the rich. I mean, yes. The Republicans, now that they're out of power, are screaming about the deficit. But if you look back to go back to Reagan, say, the big deficit increases were under Reagan, under Bush 2, and under Donald Trump. And the causes were tax cuts to the rich.
If of course.
Those taxes were what they used to be, we would have a lot more money than we do. and probably the taxes on working people will be less. There was a study came out. I mentioned it last week. It was called It's Time to Tax the Billionaires. It was in the New York Times a week ago. And Chris, if you can find that and put it in the chat, it's worth people reading that. And there's a little chart in there, and it shows that the billionaires are paying on average 23% of their income. Those of us in the working class, 50% median and down, are paying 24% of our income.
It's crazy.
Yeah, those tax cuts got to go. And, you know, the Republicans led them, but the Democrats have not repealed them when they've had the power.
Right, right. So, and that's your problem with the Democrats. We get a lot of empty promises from them. I mean, they had all the power in 08, 09, and 10 when Obama first got elected, and we couldn't even pass a public option. You know, they've had the power and the popular vote for most of this century so far, and we still lost Roe v. Wade. So, I mean, you know, you have a far-right party and a spineless corporate-owned party that really sits in the center but claims to sit on the left because they know where they need to get their votes from. You know, it's really time for a change, or at least hold that party accountable. We know what we're going to get from the GOP. You know, it's the false hope in the other party that's really destroying working people as a whole in this country.
Amen. You know, if there's not a party on the left, the Democrats will keep chasing the Republicans to the right.
As they've been doing.
They take the left votes for granted, and they go chasing votes on the right side of the spectrum.
Right. And you know the definitions of insanity as well as I do. We keep doing the same thing over and over. We're going to get the same result.
Yep. Vicky Corden, affordable housing is another issue. How do we stop hedge fund companies from buying every house and apartment and mobile home park in the country?
Honestly, and again, not an issue that I really came into this thinking a lot about, but should have. You know, why can't municipalities start buying up that land themselves? Why can't states start buying up that land themselves? Why can't we put a moratorium on what these big hedge funds can buy and can't buy? I'm going to hear people tell me about freedom and, you know, that's not what this country's about. Let's not forget that when this country was founded and these laws were written, you know, there weren't hedge funds. There wasn't out of control capitalism at the time. We weren't in danger of wealthy people and foreign countries buying up everything that we can't afford to buy right now. You know, in my town where I grew up, Rochelle Park, my father bought his house, the house I grew up in, I think it was for like $60,000, and that was 1981. You know, he's passing and the estate coming out of the probate process. Now I got to list that house on the market. It's a little house. It's a nice house. It's a nice area, but it's small. It's like 1,100 square feet. And, you know, I have it listed for $495. I don't know how people up here are surviving paying, because, I mean, the interest rates right now are absolutely insane. When you have a few billion dollars, I really don't think you're that worried about interest rates or, you know, the land being worth, you know, 100% more than it was yesterday. But when you're a working person, you're trying to do the impossible. So, you know, I would definitely fight for the ability of municipalities, counties, states, so on and so forth, to possibly buy up that land and get into that business to an extent. We're probably far from that. That might be a pipe dream. And another thing I do want to say that we haven't really even said is, you know, there's a lot of issues that I have a feel for but need to be educated on. And I truly believe that any representative that you elect is only going to be as good as the people he puts around him or her. So, you know, the key is to put good people around me once we win this campaign, once we get this guy out of office, and make sure that we're working for the people by listening to them and by me getting educated by the right people who I put around me. I mean, a big part of leadership is the decisions on the team you put around you. So, you know, that's what I'm hoping to do the right way. But yeah, I mean, housing is a problem. I see it. I know it. I don't know how people are surviving with the prices today. And, you know, any good ideas that someone can give me to help working people, you know, grab the dream of owning a home at a reasonable rate, I'm all in favor of.
Well, what you just suggested is what is not being proposed in this country, but Europe does. You know, less than 1% of our housing units are publicly owned.
Right.
And there's a cap on it, thanks to the Clinton administration and Andrew Cuomo, the guy that I ran against here in New York when he was HUD secretary, called the Faircloth Amendment, that says they cannot build any more public housing units unless they're replacing ones they tore down. So the market is dominated by, since the 2008 financial crisis, by this Wall Street hedge fund money. They bought up everything that was, you know, foreclosed and for sale. And now they're the biggest landlords in the country. Now, what they do in Europe is they build what they call social housing, public housing. Some is cooperative, some of it's owned by municipalities. But in those countries, you know, 10, 20, 30% of the housing is publicly owned, which creates enough affordable housing that the private rental market has to compete with it. Like Vienna in Austria, over a third of their housing is publicly owned. And so, you know, the private businesses, you know, landlords and developers are in business, but they can't just jack up the prices because people will go to the public housing. So I think you just hit on the, you know, radical in the sense of getting at the root of the problem answer.
Listen, and they're thriving. I mean, you know, it's always good when we have a public company up against the private corporations. I tell people all the time, you know, if there wasn't a postal service right now, how much do you think it would cost you to mail that check to the company that you're trying to pay or, you know, send any letter? I guarantee it wouldn't be 50 cents anymore.
Yeah. It would be what UPS and FedEx and are charging you. And they'd be charging more if there wasn't a post office.
Of course. Of course. So be careful what you wish for sometimes.
Vicki Corden, how can we get free or almost free education for college and trade schools? Student loans are turning into black holes.
That's, I think, pretty simple. And we talked about it earlier. We have to appropriately tax wealthy people. There's plenty of money there to send everybody to college. And listen, if you're a patriot, if you really love this country and you want to see this country thrive and be number one, then why would you be opposed to any citizen who wants to advance his knowledge or her knowledge, being able to go back to school and learn something new or just learn something that they want to learn? I mean, the more you learn, the better you are, the better we are and stronger we are as a society. As you've seen education become harder and harder to attain, you know, Donald Trump gets 50% of the vote. I mean, you know, and again, I don't want to scare conservatives because they already have their belief that education is indoctrination. I never thought we'd see a time where being a scholar was looked at as, you know, just being an indoctrinated fool. It's crazy. I mean, it's not like I took college that seriously, but I was there long enough to know there were plenty of conservative professors, conservative students, you know, teaching what they wanted to teach. I mean, the whole point of being well-educated is hearing both sides and then making a decision. So how we get there, we tax wealthy people appropriately. And again, I don't want to scare rich people because in my district especially, there's a lot of quote-unquote rich people, people who make $250 a year, $500,000 a year, even $1 million a year. Yeah, you would probably see a tax increase in a perfect world that I was in charge of. But, you know, it's really the people that are just making exorbitant amounts of money, $100 million a year, $200 million a year. Those are the people we need to tackle. Because when you let people get that wealthy, it becomes dangerous for us in so many ways that I'm not going to get into now. But, you know, your security goes down as there are, you know, Saudis and Jeff Bezos and Bill Gates and people that just have wealth that if they never made a dime again, their great, great grandkids will probably never have to seriously get a job and work. So, you know, that's what we need to put an end to. And that's how we get more services for ourselves.
You know, you were talking about higher education and why we should, you know, get a lot of people, enable a lot of people to get an education. You sounded like a guy from New Jersey, passed on now, named Tony Mazzocchi. Did you know him?
No, I did not.
Okay, well, he was a trade union leader in the oil, chemical, and atomic workers. Okay. And he worked with Ralph Nader to get the OSHA bill passed around 1971.
Okay.
And he worked with oil, chemical, and atomic workers, the most dirty, dangerous jobs. And they were looking for ways to get beyond oil, chemicals, you know, toxic chemicals, and atomic power.
Mm-hmm.
They were talking about, they came up with the idea of what we now call the just transition, so that as workers were, the industries in which their union was working were going out of business, they would be put into new industries that were clean and, you know, like for renewable energy instead of atomic power. And he formed a labor party in the 90s that had, you know, six unions representing 11 million workers affiliated. And then they couldn't decide, you know, the unions really didn't want to run against the Democrats. Tony endorsed Ralph Nader in 2000, and that created a controversy. And then he got pancreatic cancer and died. But he had a way of speaking common sense in the way you just described why everybody should have access to higher education. Sounded just like him.
It's another
New Jersey guy.
Maybe it's a New Jersey idea. Maybe New Jersey, we're just really good at common sense. I don't know.
Well, at least you and Tony were. Z Manny, SUNY BDS announced that most of its 64 campuses agreed to join their divest campaigns together. What's the potential of this mobilizing in New York, not just Ray Gaza, but in general, and regarding signatures for Greens?
So I can't speak for New York, but basically New Jersey and New York, especially in the section I live in, are pretty much the same thing.
Z Manny followed up saying, let's put that in the context of New Jersey. The question generally of campus mobilizing.
I think it's a great thing. I think, students are always going to be, the younger generation is really where change always has to come from, because they're always the ones with the bigger ideas. Sometimes not being, wise or worldly works in your benefit, because you could come up with even crazier ideas that seem crazy at the time, but as we think about them a little more, become, sensible. I don't want to bring this back to me, but one of the biggest enemies of that BDS movement is my incumbent, Josh Gottheimer, who's just a complete enemy of free speech. As you saw recently, he's talked to Rutgers. He's getting the FBI to go and crack down on student protests. And again, you're getting the FBI involved and kids just trying to get their ideas out there. I mean, I'll never understand why it's such a bad thing to be against genocide. I'll never understand why it's such a bad thing to be against apartheid. The students are going to keep doing what they're doing. You really can't stop them. You could crack down on them as hard as you want to. We saw it during World War II. We really saw it during Vietnam. Just keep doing what you're doing. I don't know if politicians really need to get involved in what's happening in student protests outside of trying to stifle it. I mean, when politicians are doing that, we should be very wary of those types of politicians and really get them out of the way, get them the hell out of office and put just regular people in who will inspire kids to do things like this, even if we don't like it, do uncomfortable things. It's very good to put people in an uncomfortable spot. You make them think when you do. So I think we need to be wary of people who try to stifle student organization, student speech, students getting together and expressing their ideas. That's what universities, I always thought, were supposed to be for.
Exactly. And they need to stop lying about what the students are demanding. They portray them as anti-Semites, even though a large portion, a disproportionate number of the students in these encampments are Jews.
Yes.
It's a big lie. I mean, there are a few people on the fringes who have said anti-Semitic things, but that's not the character of the movement.
No.
And for the politicians and some of these people on the media, Joe Scarborough on MSNBC, they are basically calling, they're trying to agitate and create the conditions for violence.
Yeah.
And one partial answer to the question is, in New York, I don't think the students in the next 2 weeks are going to mobilize for the signatures. We've gone to the campuses, had mixed results in getting signatures. Some of the students are a little bit suspicious of, you know, older folks coming in and don't know who we are. So
as they should be, as they should be. I mean, not particularly, it works against us, but they should be wary of older people coming to the campus and trying to tell them what to do.
Yes, reasonably wary, not paranoid.
I agree. So,
anyway, we'll work that out. So I think, yeah, we need to encourage the students and defend them from the repression. And, you know, like you said, you know, colleges are supposed to be places of academic freedom and open debate.
Yes.
And these administrators, they're scared of the donors and these, you know, agitators that, you know, like the Republicans going to Columbia University and saying a bunch of lies about the students. That's pure politics, and it's creating the conditions for violence. It's terrible.
And if I could just make a point, I mean, you know, I don't understand why these Ivy League schools are so worried about their donors. As I know it, and maybe you could correct me if I'm wrong, Ivy Leagues have such immense endowments, they probably don't ever have to get a donation or even charge tuition ever again, and they would be solvent for another century. Am I incorrect in thinking that?
I think for some of the Ivies, that's true. Some of the others are still trying to get to that point. But you're right. They have huge endowments for
crazy.
The most part.
Yeah. And if I can make just another point real quick on that, we talked about how these students are being called anti-Semitic, even though, you know, the movement does have a lot of Jewish kids in it. I think it's very dangerous. And again, just not always to go back to my opponent, but, you know, the Anti-Defamation League and a lot of these what I would call far right Jewish leaders, they are watering down terms like anti-Semitism, which is dangerous for them. You know, an anti-Semite, as I know it, is a dangerous person, could be a Nazi, could be a white supremacist, could just be a racist in general. When you start lumping people into that are traditionally on your side and calling people anti-Semite, which happened to me when I was telling you about that court case, it was outrageous that there was nothing anti-Semitic in the case. And yet the prosecutor decided to throw into the case that she was Jewish and she goes to Israel. And where was this coming from? So I just want to say it's very dangerous, and they're really watering down the term anti-Semite when they start throwing people in who just want an end to genocide and apartheid in Israel. I don't even view Israelis as what you would say the Jews. They're the Israelis. If you want to support them here, that does, you know, it again, I don't want to go off on a tangent, but it's very dangerous when you start watering down terms like that, because then they mean nothing.
And you can't defend against it if you don't know what it really is.
Right.
In other words, you know, the biggest danger from anti-Semitism is on the far right.
Right. Always
you're attacking the left that has been traditionally anti-racist, including anti-Semitism. You're basically confusing people as to where, you know, the real threat to Jewish people is.
And on a personal level, I've been to a few of these protests. I've met a lot of the members of the Green 13 are very involved in those protests. I can tell you that there isn't a racist bone in these people's bodies. So it's just, it's beyond ridiculous when you call people, when you say, okay, these people are only anti-Semites, but they're not racist against them. It's the whole thing is absurd and dangerous.
Okay, well, we've come up upon an hour. I really appreciate you coming on, Bo. I think you present yourself great as a candidate, and I think you're going to put this Josh Gottheimer guy on the hot seat when you get to debate him, because you make sense.
That happens.
And I think you can take apart his nonsense. Did we have a website for you up there? Under construction. Yeah, there it is. It's under construction. So I don't know if you're accepting donations yet, but
next week we'll be up and running fully. Okay. Next week. I'm sorry. Go ahead.
I was just going to say, I hope people give you some contributions so you can get your campaign up and running, and good luck.
And I can't stress, this is not about me. It's about the opponent that I'm up against. You know, we start to take our government back when we get rid of people like the person who's running, who's representing New Jersey 5 right now.
And we got Bo's Twitter for Congress in the feed, so you can check him out there. I did look at that. He's been tweeting, so you can follow Bo.
Maybe to a fault, but yes, you're getting the truth with me. You know, I'm not going to pull punches with anybody. I'm just like you. So we're here to represent you.
Okay, well, great. So, just to wrap up for this week, I don't have a guest scheduled for next week, although candidates are starting to call, and I've mentioned some other people that I hope to get on soon. And actually been in touch with Greens from Georgia, the country, not the state, where people are out on the streets against this foreign agents law, which they see as suppression of democracy and attempt by the government to block the way that the majority of people want toward a relationship with the EU. So Russia already has troops in Georgia going back to the 90s. They've got control of two of their provinces. So that's a new crisis area. And there are Greens who have played a significant role in getting independence and democracy started in Ukraine. Now, they're struggling to keep it. So maybe we'll have them on soon. I've been trying to get them on another discussion for the Ukraine Solidarity Network. So we're working on that. But after we get them on there, if they're any good, I'm going to try to get them on this podcast too. So we'll learn more about what's going on there. And other than that, I wish everybody a good week. Get out there and petition if you can. Actually, now I'm thinking I saw a question in the chat about, I can't remember what it was, but it had something to do with petitioning and I wanted to answer it. But let me just glance at these, see if I can find it right away.
While you're looking for that, Howie, I just want to say thank you so much for this opportunity. We're going to make a lot of noise. We're going to make a lot of noise in New Jersey because we're right and we're doing it for the right reasons. So thank you again for this time. It's an honor.
Oh, the question was from Trey Woodford. Does Maryland need a petition or are they already on the ballot? They definitely need a petition. They need 10,000 good signatures. The deadline, I don't think it's coming right up, but it is coming up and they need help. So if you're in Maryland, contact the Maryland Green Party or look up the National Green Party and ballot access. You should be able to hook up there, but I know they could use some help in Maryland. So yeah, that was a question I wanted to answer. So, all right, Bo, thanks for coming.
Thank you.
We got power, love.